Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. The podcast. We are helping the good people win the rhetoric wars. And the wars are raging out there every day. There's lots of people talking who want different things. These are complicated times. They require sophisticated techniques. So that's what we're trying to hand out, a little more sophistication. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer from Hollywood, and founder of Rhetoric Warriors. So each week I bring on a different person. Sometimes I've been doing them every day. Like I've been releasing these every day for the last couple of weeks because I have so many people to talk to. Sometimes that's a comedian and I explore their politics. Sometimes I do conversion on somebody that I think needs to be converted to a different politics. And sometimes I bring on experts who have really interesting areas of expertise and experience. And that's this guy this week. This my guest this week is a speaker. He's a writer. He's a consultant. His PhD in interpersonal communication from UT Austin, which is where I went to school for my master's degree. And he works for some really great organizations out there in the world doing interesting stuff. So he's going to be a fun guy to talk to. So everybody welcome Jeff Tumlin. Jeff.
Hey, Dan. How you doing?
Good, man. That's the most artistic background I think anybody's had. You've got like abstract art right behind your head.
That's the Hilton, whatever Hilton hotel I'm at. They put, I don't even know, I haven't looked at it, but yeah, they got, that's like a Rubik's Cube that got run over by an 18 wheeler.
Yeah, but you know, they have that thing where people will critique people's backgrounds. I think yours would do really well. You got that nice green turquoisey kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like those colors are throwbacks to the 70s when those were actually the colors back in the day when I was a boy growing up.
Well, you're in the Southwest, right? You said you're in Pecos.
Yep. I'm in, it's West Texas, roughly in between Midland and El Paso. So yeah,
beautiful.
I got some, you know what they say, the old saying, it's only art if you don't understand it.
You're in that beautiful tabletop, like tennis area of, it's like, I always describe it, it's like a ping pong table with somebody just spread dirt on, and that's West Texas. Like it's just flat dirt.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the Sand Hills State Park in Monahans?
I heard all those words and I cannot identify any of them.
And so Monahans is maybe 45 minutes away from to the west of Midland. And there's a Texas State Park called Monahans Sand Hills State Park that it looks like you're in the sand dunes of Baja, California. There's just no ocean. And so it's totally a mind trick. And so if you drive through there, you'll be like, hey, we're going to the beach. We're going. And you will never get to the beach from.
You know, Texas is this weird testament to nature that nature's like, I'm going to grow here. I don't care what you try to do. I don't care how hot it is, how dry it is. I'm still going to be here.
Yeah.
There are things in Texas that grow like out of wood. I'm like, how does this?
Yeah, insane. It's crazy. Yeah, I am more terrified on my jogs here because I routinely cross coyotes and they're like, hey, what are you doing, idiot? I mean, you know, what are you doing?
You're not natural to this environment.
Yeah,
we are.
That's right. You're going to get run over by a truck or something's going to eat you. So I get back into your hotel with your abstract art.
So I gave a little quick overview of you there without much specifics. Go into your background just a little bit for people so they can get a understanding of what you do and who you are and what you're about.
Sure. Yeah. A kind of straightforward backstory. I'm born and raised Houston boy. Got a chance to go to the military academy. I wasn't militarily inclined, but West Point had basically changed my dad's life. So I knew just enough to know that it was a good place and there were good people there. And so I went, that led to a 5-year stint in the Army, which I did 4 of those 5 years in Hawaii in the 90s. And everything that you're imagining happened. Like it all happened. It's crazy. But that was a great time. a very, very good job for a young person, a young man or a young woman. And then I use my veterans benefits to go back and study communication, which is something that I loved. We had some electives at West Point, but not a lot. There were no communication classes. There were no business courses. And so I was able to use those veterans benefits to go back. And that eventually culminated in, as you mentioned, an interpersonal doctorate, studying with some amazing people that we know collectively. Mark Knapp was my advisor. John Daly was a close friend and advisor, just like Mark was. Howard Prince, a number of people there at UT. And then in the way that life kind of unfolds, I had a chance to help build out a leadership center at the University of Texas with a psychologist named Howard Prince, who's a great friend and mentor of mine. He was also, in the way that the world works, my dad's roommate in the Army.
Really?
And so I always tell people, they're like, man, how'd you get that job? I'm like, ah.
That's a pretty good one.
Let me tell you. Yeah. Can your dad say that he lived with your boss? Well, in that case, I don't think I'd apply for this job. But we learned a lot about communication in the PhD, learned a lot about leadership at the helping to kind of build out this leadership center. And then all of that, eventually a time period emerged when my wife was completing her doctorate and she needed to move from Texas. And so at that point, I had just enough clients to kind of scratch out an existence on my own. And, you know, I never looked back from there. And so I started consulting on a fluke. I got assigned as a TA in a summer class. And the way that my assignments were working that summer, they couldn't pay me, but the class had already started. And so the professor came to me. I'm a master's student. The professor was like, hey, we screwed up. We can't pay you. I'm so sorry. What can I do? And I'm like, oh, well, don't worry about it. This class is interesting. And I'll go ahead and see this through. And they're like, what? And I'm like, well, yeah, it's interesting. I've already started the student. And it blew their heads exploded. And the dude handed me a sheet of paper. And he's like, here's a name and here's a phone number. It's a friend of mine. I'll get you a consulting job. And that was Shell Oil. I was a master's student. And I got this gig at Shell. I remember the title, Navigating Corporate Politics. And I don't know anything about corporations. I just came out of the Army, right? And I'm a master's student. I've had almost no classes, but you know, people helped me. I pulled together material. I actually brought in my dad and we co-taught it, which was kind of neat as a father-son thing. And so that just led to a little bit here, a little bit there.
That's interesting. Let me stop you and we'll come back to your timeline there. But
yeah,
so you've got really strong ethos in your background. I mean, there are things that when you can bring these behind you, like, you know, you've got the West Point, right? And you've got UT Austin. And now you've suddenly got, I consulted at, you know, Shell Oil. That in the rhetoric game, we would call is like an ethos trifecta, you know? And it does. It, like, just the fact that you're coming from UT and there's a professor who's already, you know, suggesting you for this, gets you into Shell Oil. Now that you're in Shell Oil and you've got the leadership center. So you've got some really, I mean, nicely organized howitzers of ethos behind you. And that stuff is like, people don't understand what kind of shorthand that is for people when they're trying to decide whether to be persuaded by you or not. Like, yeah. When you can bring those things, it's such an advance, you know, it's such an advanced front that gets you so much farther in before they do any kind of balking or, you know, heavy vetting of you. If you go in there and you're an idiot, you're going to lose all that credibility. But it's great that you had those going in.
You know, yep. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. It's one of my favorite things to do. Is I watch different audiences that I go to, but you know, I do a lot of, rural, I do a lot of fire departments. Yeah. I mean, I do, you know, the Shell Oils, I've done the, you know, orthopedic surgeons at hospital. I mean, I'm into a lot of different levels and sizes, but I also do a lot of what you and I, we sometimes just call salt of the earth people, for lack of a better way of saying it. And so one of the things I love doing is before a talk, when they're reading my introduction, I'm facing the audience and there's always people and they're like this, you know, like this topic is their nightmare, like conflict resolution or, you know, right. Like, right. You know, how to influence people or communicating with difficult people. And they're like, you know, who's this guy and what's in, they're sitting and they're like, well, Dr. Tumlin is this and that and blah, blah. And invariably, when they get to the part about, and he attended West Point, these people, they go, uh-huh. And I actually see them like look up and unfreeze.
Yeah.
And they're like, and it took me years of consulting to realize what you immediately picked up. I mean, I was so, one of the things that I try to tell people when they occasionally ask, well, how do I become a consultant and this and that? I'm like, nobody knows. And everybody is just trying to take their expertise and figure out how to connect it for good. And it took me years to realize that there's not that many communication PhDs who also went to Ranger School.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like,
yeah.
Ethos, you can kind of, I kind of think of it sometimes because everybody has multiple ethos, right? There's multiple things in your biography that if they were mentioned, people will make instant judgments about you, like at least initial guesses. And that's what ethos really is at the beginning. It's that those initial guesses. And so everybody's got things in their bio. And, you know, when you add in, like you said, military, as soon as you add in military and Army Ranger and West Point and that kind of stuff, they're going to import all this stuff they would never import to an academic, right? Nobody ever hears, oh, this guy worked at the university, and then they don't think of the SEAL teams, right, you know, or something right. like that. So it's really nice, like the pipe organ metaphor is literally like you think about it as there's 50 things about you. And what you do when you go into different places is you just hit the different key for the different, you know, pipe organ to play. And yeah. I know like some of these jobs that you're doing, you probably like I know when I used to do stand-up, I never let them say I was a professor, you know, in a comedy club or a bar, something like that, because it's so dominant that I'd have sure. to deal with it.
Sure.
And with you, I'm sure like, you know, if you get to adjust your bio for what they should emphasize, you can, you know, play the pipe organ the way that you want.
Yeah. Yeah. It's smart. I mean, I'm reminded, I love that metaphor. I mean, you're great with visualization and metaphors, as you and I, we talk about that a lot. But also I'm reminded of that time when you were doing a consulting project and they found out you were a comic and they were like, make me laugh.
Yeah.
And you had to, you know, you kind of had to switch because it's dominant, like you said.
Yeah. My pipe organ has problems. Like it plays very yeah. different notes.
Yeah.
So you're a rhetorician, you know, which is kind of negative in people's, at least their original understanding of it, their connotations is when they hear rhetorician or rhetoric, they think, you know, manipulation. And yeah. so I've got to deal with that a little bit over here, but then over here they hear comedian and they don't expect quality information from comedian. So
yeah,
my pipe organ's an interesting one to play.
Yeah. 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 I have to be careful too, because similarly, people attach significance to the fact that I graduated from Ranger School or West Point. But I'm unmilitary.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely—
You disavow that pretty quickly.
Yeah. And so I followed Eric Greitens once, who's a Navy SEAL. He became the governor of Missouri. He's used to be guest host on Charlie Rose when there was a Charlie Rose deal. And so, I mean, really good guy, but here comes Greitens and he's this American hero. And then here comes Jeff, and I'm just a, you know, moderately goofy dude who ended up at the military academy because that was the best, dude, that was the best college I could get into. And you don't turn that down, right? And then, you know, but I love flowers. And up until that point, I was writing a lot of poetry. And for heaven's sakes, I tell people I was on the tennis team, you know? And so I come on after this legitimate, what I would call almost hero type guy. And the audience is like, who is this bizarro? He's not a Ranger, but why is he saying he went to, you know, it was just, and I remember thinking, I'm like, oh, I should have read the program.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. And you have, I would say the strongest pipe in your pipe organ really is when the ethos you establish once you meet you. Like there's your biography ethos that's just flat 2D on paper. But as soon as you meet you, like, I think your nice guy ethos takes over. You just seem like such a nice human being. Well-meaning, moral, engaged.
Labrador retriever, man.
You know, all that stuff, which is super powerful. If you can establish that again, and you do very well establishing that in the moment when people meet you, again, they move everything else out of the way. They stop questioning everything else because they like that piece of ethos.
Yeah, appreciate that. That's very kind. Yeah. Yeah, man. I don't have any pit bull in me, man. I had to marry a pit bull because I'm all Labrador. I'll keep getting the ball. You want me to go? I'll go get the ball, Dan. You want me to go get the ball? You want a stick? I'll bring a stick, you know?
No, that's great. And I would think in your field of consulting, I mean, that personality probably works pretty well because you work across so many different communities. You've got to do a certain type of politics to get them to accept you and accept your help and your perspective on things. And I would think that ethos plays very well with people because you're not trying to intimidate, you're trying to communicate.
Yeah, I probably couldn't do it any other way, Dan. So I'm lucky that it works because if it didn't, I'd have real trouble. But yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I'm trying to figure out how to either help people think of something that they haven't thought of before that might improve their life in the company, or I'm trying to help them unwind an actual problem that's either tripping them up or that they've become so frustrated with that they're either close to losing hope or they're exhibiting counterproductive behaviors that are starting to kind of infect a wider and wider circle. So
we'll talk about that a little bit. Like, talk about some of your favorite consulting things, the things that you like to bring, you know, to organizations that seem to work best for your approach.
So sometimes I think of kind of the work that I do as the three C's, where there's coaching, there's consulting, and then there's classes. And so, you know, like you can take the academic out of the classroom, but you can't take the classroom out of the academic. And so there's just something about, if you get your reps in, like, dude, I got my reps in. I've taught hundreds of college classes like you have. And so you just have that feel, right? Like, I imagine comedians must, where they can get certain, and so they love that, because it's never the same thing. No two classrooms are the same. So I love the teaching and the speaking part. The coaching, I find that I'm a better good to great coach. And I really have to push myself when somebody's totally screwing up. I've done the big screw up coaching before where somebody's about to get fired. But that's more, I have to channel more of my inner pit bull, of which I have almost none. Whereas in the good to great, that's just all Labrador. And so, you know, I'm good to go. I mean, I'll tell you how awesome you are all day long. And, you know, we can, how long you want that to go? And you'll feel great. You'll be like, my God, this is the best. And it will be because you're already good. and I'm just helping you like that. So I have to work a lot harder. I have to work a lot harder when it's an actual individual problem and I'm the guy face to face that has to tell them that. That stuff is easier for my wife, just to use her as an example. We're in this work together. Her PhD is in organizational behavior, also from the University of Texas. But she's more naturally inclined to tell people what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. And so the last kind of C is for me is the consulting. And that's when, maybe something's gone wrong between two parts of an organization. Maybe you've actually got a whole part of your organization where you're having a lot of turnover and you're trying to figure out what the heck's going on. And those type of what I would call direct action consulting is the hardest stuff I do, because by the time somebody's paying a consultant, they have tried every obvious thing and they've been thinking about this problem for 1,000 hours. And so I roll in at hour one and it's literally everything in my life I've ever learned. And the government's been good to me. I have never paid a dollar for a class from K through PhD. The government paid for every dollar and I'm grateful for it. And everything that I've learned, I need everything to try to, because those things are so hard, just so hard, but such a great challenge if you can kind of manipulate the jigsaw puzzle.
Well, and you really are at that point brought in as like the intellectual SEAL team. Right. We don't want you here for 6 months, you know, occupying the place. We want you here for 45 minutes, you know, deal and leave.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what people, you know, a lot of times believe they're buying from intellectuals, especially have an expertise in their area, is that they will bring in these pre-made solutions. And the reality is when you get in, human beings are complicated. Yeah. Situations are complex. You can have ideas, but you don't know what will actually work until you get in there and, you know, do some real analysis and some real, you know, information gathering so that you know what theories to apply. And I'm sure you have to do that a lot. And it's a lot of pressure to come up with that kind of communication in the moment so that you don't lose credibility with these people, but you also don't give them an easy but wrong answer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the most humbling, in some ways, it's the most humbling profession I can imagine, because you're constantly trying to not lie, not be wrong, and absorb everything that's going on to help people who earnestly want to make something better, but they're stuck. And it's compounded by, my theory is that people are getting weirder, and I blame the internet 100%, because from my natural experiment on me, I know that ever since the internet came along, I've been getting weirder. Because all those little quirky parts that I thought, oh, well, that's just me, I should probably keep that hidden. Well, now it's like I said a few minutes ago, I love flowers. Well, I always thought I should keep that to myself because there's not that many flower sniffing rangers. But if you type in flower sniffing ranger on Google, dude, there's a whole bunch of us out there. And so then that emboldens me to, like, you know, I think I'm going to fly my freak flag a little higher. And
is that the extent of your freak flag, Jeff, that you like to smell flowers? That's the weird, as weird as you get. That's what you're admitting to in front of the whole world.
PG-13, man.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I like a rose. Okay.
Fine. That's right. That's right. That's it. That's my dirty little secret. Right. Yeah. So it's, but if you believe me, or if you just think of it, let's do a thought exercise. If you buy into the fact that maybe people are getting weirder and maybe being able to atomize into sub Reddits and then feel like you have a whole crew, saying exactly whatever your weird thing is, that then makes you weirder. Well, now I take an organization and I put all these people in it. There's more variation in the behavior. And so there's less predictability. And so you cannot go in with a box to anything, man. And I know you know this, Dan. I'm talking to the choir here.
No, this is great. Because this is people listening in and trying to get an understanding of, you know, these kind of things from an expert with inside of it talking outward. So yeah, roll with it.
Yeah. So it's harder because there's more variability in the behavior. And so even you and I, 20 years ago, 10, 20, and you know, you have to constantly stay updated with what you know and what the science is saying and what other people in your profession are doing. You know, the beauty of, like, last night I read a book, it cost me on my Kindle $9.99 from Marshall Goldsmith, probably the best coach in the world. And for $10, a dude who is better than me at what I'm doing is telling me how to do what I'm getting paid to do. I mean, dude, that's priceless. And you have to stay updated because there is no in a box solution. And it's a matter of, I have certain instincts from dealing with people in organizations for a number of years now. And I have a lot that I've learned intellectually that I can go to the mental Rolodex, so to speak. I know that's an archaic term, but the mental category system. And there will be things that I can pull out that may help and plug in. But humbling job to try to be as precise and accurate as you can without, you can't, there is no in-a-box solution, because I can literally get on the interstate and from where I am now, I can go to the next hospital. And it's just a fluke from where I'm sitting today. I happen to work for two hospitals on the same highway, 45 minutes apart. And doesn't work. What you do in one place, you can't do in the other. And that's how it is, man.
Well, you know, when you look at expertise as an area of persuasion, you know, that's so, so powerful when you're starting to deal with strangers, right? That's how one of the first things we try to ascertain about other people is how smart are they, how up and informed are they on different topics. And if we hear somebody has a super expertise, like I have a buddy from Kentucky who plays the banjo.
Awesome.
As soon as people hear banjo, and he makes banjos.
Wow.
Like from scratch, and has been doing this for 40 years, and his whole family plays musical instruments and all this stuff. But as soon as you hear that, you import all this expectation and credibility, but it's so specific. You know, does that tear away your expertise in other areas? Like I said, Kentucky, and I said banjo.
Right. So now you're going to tell me he's not splitting atoms for a living, right?
He's a super smart guy. Like I call him I've actually had him on the podcast. I call him a Kentucky Renaissance guy.
Wow.
He's like a 4-star chef, builds his own musical instruments, builds bikes, hasn't driven a car in 30 years, is a, you know, bike enthusiast.
Yeah.
And has done real estate consulting forever. So he's a super sharp guy. But managing your ethos, managing your expertise ethos, even for guys like you that have a PhD, you know, and lots of experience in consulting, and you've got the Leadership Center back there, and you've got good associations with really smart people that you've worked with or taken classes with, that's a big import, right? That's a big biomass of expertise.
Sure.
Yeah. But it still gets winnowed down into the moment. You've got to prove that you can say something smart and useful in that moment, or they'll literally take all of that formalized expertise and you become worse than, you know, somebody with low expertise. You become somebody who has fake expertise. And that is so hated in America.
Yeah.
That's why expertise in general is easily stained, because they see it as fake expertise. So you've got to demonstrate it with that organization, which I'm sure you do constantly, right? You constantly feel that pressure to say something useful, say something interesting, or you're going to be questioned and not paid or never brought back.
Yeah, it was one of my first lessons is a simple story, but it's exactly this point, is it was an organizational turnaround and I was supposed to basically tell the owner of the company what he should do. Simple, go around, go on a listening tour, take a week, and then Friday morning, tell me what's what, tell me what I should do. And so I go around, I do my listening tour, I do all this stuff, and I'm done early. I mean, I got this, right? So I'm done by like Wednesday night, and I get my report, my PowerPoints together, my main, you know, I got it, I'm good to go. Got it in a day early. So Thursday, I finished the last of my tours, but I've already done my report. And this guy comes up at a break and he says, "Hey, have you ever thought that the problem actually isn't here in the company, but it's with the suppliers?" And to be honest, I wanted a break. It was a listening tour. I needed to go to the restroom. And so I'm like, half of me is like, I just want out of here. And I'm just going to say something to this guy so I can go on a break and make him feel like it's okay. And the other half of me is like, and so I just sat there and I said, "Tell me more." And the dude basically in about 90 seconds lays out a totally alternate theory. And he was right. And I'm like, the irony is I was on a listening tour, but I wasn't even listening. And it took a dude actually coming, the guy actually came up to me with the answer. And I wanted to go to the bathroom instead of listen to the answer that the next morning I was supposed to be delivering. And I never forgot that lesson. And so I have this learned my normal instinct by default as a human being is I think they're paying me, I'm the expert, I need to talk. And I've learned to override that, because half of the time when people are pausing, that's not my cue to jump in and show them how smart I am. That's them testing the ice to see if they can trust me at the next level to tell me the thing I really need to know. And so I tell people all the time, some of these stories, I'm altering slight details because it would be obvious with my client list who I'm talking about. So I work for an extremely esoteric company, famous, world famous company years ago. I still work with them periodically. They're very famous kind of entertainment, of which I know nothing. I mean, I don't know anything about entertainment. And the leader brought me in after a seminar I was teaching, and he liked the teaching so much that he brought me in. He's like, "All right, here's my problem. I got these actors over here. I got these people over here working on the stage. I got these." And he's basically asking me what he should do artistically with one of the greatest organizations in the world. And in the back of my head, this huge alarm bell is going off of my mouth got me into this room. But if I don't stop with my mouth and start with my ears, I am going to actually get fired from every job from here on out. And so I hit this point about maybe 10 years ago when I stopped talking and started listening probably, I don't know, a factor of 2 times more, maybe 3 times more. And it made all the difference. My mouth got me to a place where I actually almost, I was in the position of beginning to be able to bankrupt my company because people would assume things that were so patently false. And if I, the urge is show them, you know, talk. But I had to learn to fight that and actually say, well, you know, the normal, a million rhetorical questions that, you know, well, what would you do? Well, what do you think? What's a time like this from your past? And how can you, and help them think through, because that's what they actually needed, is a co-investigator, not the answer.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think one of the things you find with true experts is that they have a few things. It's not that you have a storehouse of knowledge. You know, they have that, but that's not the important part. The important part is they have a deep yearning for the right answer. They will never be happy with a lesser answer. And that's why you see really good academics. They will study something for years, decades, because they need to get to the right answer. And that yearning, that commitment to the right answer, sounds like that little story you told is a perfect demonstration of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me, I mean, you know, we share so many common people from UT. I remember in my early days of the PhD, when I didn't really know what I was doing, like most early, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And so I asked Mark Knapp, who's a legend in communication. I asked him, I'm like, hey, so are we qualitative or quantitative? And he's like, Jeff, we're whatever we need to be to answer the question. And I was like, got it. It's all I need to know. And you're right.
Oh, yeah. He's quantitative. Come on.
Yes. Yeah.
That department was interesting because I came through there as a master's student. And so it was my first experience, my first exposure to the field of communication. And this was back in 85, before like there was a wave of cultural studies and, you know, qualitative ethnography and that stuff that came in and started to compete within communication. It had come from the communication science tradition, you know, post the 50s and post the war with, you know, social science. And those guys were all social scientists. I mean, even Hart was a counter, you know, he loved quantitative programs and counting words and drawing conclusions from that. And it's a great way of studying things. It's a wonderful way to find insights and support your guesses and that kind of stuff. So I really appreciate it. But then when I went to University of South Florida, which was this incredibly dedicated to the qualitative ethnographic, like Art Bochner, you know, famous name in interpersonal comm, had just basically thrown over the entire field and, you know, was done with quantitative analysis and moved strongly over into story and, you know, qualitative and, you know, autoethnography and all this kind of stuff. And so I got a huge dose of that and I realized, oh, Texas never taught me any of that at all. Like, so I left there with a strong, you know, scientific quantitative expertise, but it was half of the field, you know, it wasn't.
I love, when I used to go to the conventions, you know, the NCAs or the international one, I used to love reading the program book, and just because say whatever else you want about communication studies, but they will allow you to study anything.
Sure.
If you want to study left-handed people from Kentucky who build banjos and play basketball and have 160 IQ, hey man, no problem. We'll let you study that. You know, you want a thesis or a dissertation? I mean, anything.
Yeah, it's gorgeous for that. It is I always loved it because it's so pliable as an area of intellectual interest.
Yeah. You can do anything with it. Yeah,
you can, everybody has to talk. Every area of humanity has to talk. And ergo, if there's talk going on, you can go study it from a communication perspective. So it's a nice entree into a lot of things. You know, and the other thing I think that I pulled from your story, which I think is really powerful about ethos and expertise, it's not always bringing understood compendium of information. It's the ability to recognize the right answer. you know, part of it is what you're talking about, where you have a process for bringing that answer, that quality answer up from people yeah. by giving them the opportunity with the right kind of questioning and the right communication environment and safety and validation and all that kind of stuff, which are great interpersonal areas of study and very powerful. But you have to have somebody there who, when somebody says the right answer, you've got the right answer ears.
Yeah.
Recognize it. It always amazes me. I'll hear people say really smart things that, you know, have real unlocking potential to a problem and nobody can hear it. Like the rest yeah. of them just act like, ah, whatever, next.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. Yeah. That right yeah. there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great point, Dan. I mean, sometimes I think the most powerful part of my job is that I'm the convener. And if I wasn't in your organization, we would not be sitting in this room. You'd be doing 10 million other things. And because I'm here and because you're paying, you're going to stop. And we're going to either explore something new that we should have been thinking about, or we're going to look at how we're stuck in a particular area. And then it's, you know, I don't know why it took me this long to figure out, but I'm one of the classes that I took was mediation at the University of Texas. And I'm so grateful I did, because basically it pounded into my head, you don't have the answer. The other party, the job is to help them come to the answer. And that's a lot of what an effective facilitator does, is like you talked about. I mean, you have to, the same people who, when they're in that room, ignore each other, one facilitator with the right approach, and I've made plenty of mistakes, and I've done this wrong many, many, many times. But when I'm at my best, and when other people like me who are like, and I know you can do this, when you're at your best, you're trying to help people slightly see themselves from a different perspective. And so it's you'll know the words for this, of what's happening, but there's part of what they believe inside is shifting slightly, because they're in the same meeting room where they're usually fighting, but now there's another guy in here and we're doing something different in here. And so now I'm looking at this situation slightly different. The insertion of a consultant or a facilitator is inorganic. It's novel. Mm-hmm. And instead of running from that, which, you know, there's occasionally, it's easy to be nervous as a consultant and feel like, why do I have this visitor badge or this or that? Which usually I try to get them to give me a regular badge, but you know, you never know. I try to embrace that, because they almost never want me to help them be the same anyway. And so it's another lever in me gently encouraging them to get out of a rut, whatever that may be.
Well, I think that's really an interesting point, that when you look at persuasion, and persuasion really wants to, you know, rhetoricians want to look at the entire ecology and see everything that they can possibly use to increase their effectiveness. And the fact that you come in there with your expertise ethos, but you also have your communicator ethos, like just yeah. talking about yourself right there as a mediator, facilitator for a second, versus consultant and communication specialist, changes the way people are going to interact with you, changes the way that they're going to, you know, want to communicate within or act within that space. I had a guy on here last week who is a world famous mediator. He's just a wonderful guy. He's been around, I think he's in his 80s now, and he started wow. some of yeah. some of the primary mediation centers in the world.
Wow.
And just the fact of what he brings of 50 years of mediation. Yeah. And he told me, I don't know, I guess 45 minutes into the interview, he'd been paid one time for mediation in his entire life. He always does it for free.
Wow. And why? I'm fascinated.
Because one, he feels like he was a lawyer as well and a professor. So he had an income from other places, but he did this out of a moral conviction of how important it is to bring this to people in the world.
Yeah.
He didn't want to compound it with money.
Wow.
But just saying that changes the nature of it.
Sure.
But I think communicator is a really interesting identity to bring to people. It's much safer. It's much, I think, less intimidating than persuasion expert or rhetorician. It's I'm a communication expert. I know how to facilitate everybody talking well so that we can find the, you know, the solution together. And I think that works really well with your natural ethos of nice guy, like you said, you know, Labrador and all that stuff. And the communicator thing seems perfect for you.
Well, appreciate it. Yeah, it would be hard to go too far outside of that. You know, it's sometimes people ask me, you know, when I have the answer, I usually will try to pull it out of you. The only reason I have an answer usually, because I mean, you're in so deep into a place. You're in so deep. Like if I'm in a hospital and we're talking about new service lines, I mean, dude, I am deep into the DNA of this stuff. And they're the experts, not me. I'm just listening to it all. And so you have to, when you recognize, okay, I got it. They put this together, this piece and this piece. And I go, wait a minute, what just happened? And they're like, that's what we have to try. Why haven't we tried it? And it's that, because those kind of flashes of insight where I don't know why those two things work, but I'm watching what's happening. And I know that that thing and then this thing, 15 minutes later, those two go together because of what happened in the room. And then you stop and you're like, wait a minute, did you catch that? And somebody else catches that. And then they actually put the words behind it. And that's the job, man. That's the gift of a discipline that will let you study absolutely anything. Is that it's two things are true at the same time. There's more, like you bring up that mediator. Well, that dude has forgotten more about mediation than I'll probably ever know. And so on the one hand, there's so much knowledge out there that we're nothing compared to that. But on the other hand, if you get the reps in, you start to see some stuff. And so those are very dissonant, but they both coexist. And it's part of it's true. I think that people are getting weirder, but in a way I'm grateful for that. Because when people weren't being weird, they weren't being themselves. Now, could I use a little less weirdness in certain areas? I absolutely certainly could. But I'm all for the spirit of people being able to be more of themselves. And I don't want to go back to the old way, even though that is making my job so much harder, because I honestly don't know what's going to happen. And the only thing that I think maybe like that is this improv that you and I occasionally talk about, where it's the river is constantly moving and I'm never in the same place. And I may have, if I'm Dan French, I've got 30 years of bits and material I can draw from, but I can never put it together in the same way in the moment. And that's how people know you're making a connection. There's a lady I work with out of Austin named Margaret Keys, and she was probably one of the most intuitive people I ever met. And she was one of the people instrumental in helping me. I mean, I thought a communication degree was to talk. And then I realized it's not. It's to not talk. and it's to observe and all this other stuff. And she was one of the people who helped me do that. And she used to have a saying, connect, don't perform. And that what we're trying to do when people feel like it's just a script, I'm telling you stuff I've told, they don't want that. But when it feels like that person listening, that I've had human beings in heavy metal company, not heavy metal, but like big tool companies with big meat hook hands, become so emotional about how much they love the company and want to fix it that they're crying. And that only happens when you're like, you walk in. Like, I remember walking in and I'm like, this guy could kill me if he wants. He's 20 years older than me. And basically I sit down and I'm like, sir, my name is Jeff, and I'm trying to work with the owners to help us figure out why we're not able to produce like we used to be able to in the last 3 years. Why is everything slowing down? And I said, and I told, I was like, sir, to be honest, I have no specialty in this area. My only specialty is trying to get people who may not be telling each other the truth or may not be talking as much as they should to each other to talk more. Can you help me figure out what's going on? And sometimes it just takes that very honest disclosure of, you know, I think sometimes my wife says, don't stop doing this. But sometimes I'll tell people, I have no idea what's going on. She's like, well, who told you to say that? I'm like, I don't know. I need to just tell these people. I have no idea what's going on. But I'm sitting here looking at 20 of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. Why can't we figure this out? Where are we screwing this up? And then sometimes that triggers, you know, an opportunity.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, you know, one of the things that's really powerful about communication is really a process expertise. Yeah. It's not a content expertise. It's never exactly stable. It's never exactly the same things twice. It's understanding all the small myriad processes within human communication and being able to enact those and sort of give them guidelines so that they don't go off the rails, to amplify them and, you know, clean them up so that they're working well, to see when they're not working well and know how to go in and fix that. But that kind of process expertise, I think, again, is probably what your super offer is to people. And you don't know what process to apply until you start to see the dynamics. You start to see, oh, these people aren't disclosing to each other. These people have animosity towards each other. They're not giving the solutions that they probably have.
Yeah.
You know, and you enable that because you bring that in again as part of your ethos, that I am here to help you to a different type of process than you're used to using.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a great offer. I mean, to be able to say, I'm going to bring a guy in here. He knows nothing at all about Caterpillar 4 million ton trucks.
Nothing.
And I promise you, at the end of 3 days, he's going to have everybody talking to each other and it's going to feel like a different place. I mean, that's kind of a super sell of, you know, what you do.
Sure.
But that's the offer.
Yep.
And communication, yeah, I think, carries that. And I did about 25% of my education in interpersonal, because in the same way, I always found it fascinating, relationships and what can be done with them with communication processes when you're trained into processes. My father was Welsh and a carpenter and didn't talk. I would be with him for hours and he would never say anything.
Sure.
And I'm like, this is awful. This is awful. I dislike the silence, non-talking thing.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the reasons I went into communication is like, I mean, there has to be other ways of doing this. And you start to realize there's a massive world of techniques that have been taught and that can be learned and practiced and executed. And it's such a nice feeling to know that no matter where you go in, you mentioned improv, and improv is a collection of comedy techniques, yes, and things like that, which are really nice, little essential, powerful techniques. I mean, little strands of communication techniques. So everybody really enjoys it when they learn them. But when you really get into communication, you realize they're endless. These little mechanisms are endless. And when you find a nice, what I would call a mid-crow or sort of middle ground technique, like when you went through, you showed me your stuff about giving people feedback, you know, sure, instead of criticism. Yeah. That's well articulated. It becomes a tool that people can use in this very, you know, repetitive way in every area of their life, whether it's work or relationships or strangers or anything. And when you pull those kind of tools out, and I think you do it very well, and you hand them to people, they're grateful because you've given them an expertise that they can use in their life.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Yeah. To me, that's the job of a PhD. The job is take this crazy, complicated stuff and pull the stuff that I can actually use. I mean, there's a little more to it. You need to be curious and always looking for the questions, but I've always felt exactly to your point that the translator role, I actually think nobody cares that I have a PhD. They only care that there's something from that I can hand them right now. Mm-hmm. I'm handing you this thing. And you, as soon as you see it, you know, boom, that's actually going to make my life better. That's exactly what I'm looking for. That will help me be able to communicate better with my dad. That will help me be able to figure out why I'm so defensive and stop that or whatever. And it's, it's the best. In many ways, I was drawn to the people. And my higher education graduate experience was exclusively at University of Texas. So I only have that one area, but that whole cluster of people wanted to find ways to actually help inform. You know, one of the greatest stats that I read maybe 2 weeks ago was they estimate that over a third of all scientists are now studying something COVID related. And that's it, man, as we well should be. And we should be studying political fragmentation, and we should be studying inequality and all the things that people are studying. What we should be studying, you know, academics get a lot of crap for another dissertation on Shakespeare, but that's not what's really happening.
Yeah. And people again, with politics, Reagan, I think, started this, pulling the educational system over into the political system so you could bat it around like a cat and a ball of yarn and blame it on things and blame intellectuals and defund it and all that kind of stuff from a small government perspective. And I get it as a rhetoric, and I get it why it's effective. But when things like COVID happen, turns out you want a lot of really smart people,
yeah,
trained and ready to go.
Yeah.
Because this stuff, you know, the world is dangerous. And you can say academics are just studying, you know, pencil erasers for $400 million. But turns out they do a lot more than that. And you probably want to respect that area of expertise more, because you want human beings going into that. You don't want them just going into Wall Street or just going to, you know, sell a better Band-Aid. You want them thinking, you know, deeply about the things that are going to determine the quality of our life and the possibility of whether we get to live on this planet or not.
Yeah.
You want them figuring that stuff out.
Yeah.
That's why I'm grateful. We'd see, you know, run into guys like you, and I was in communication and academics for a long time. But then when you run into people outside and they're doing things in the world, it always fascinates me to see what they've harvested and how they're taking it out, you know, into the world and using it. And it's fun to watch what you do with it.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Yeah. I'll trade you a compliment. And, you know, every Monday morning, the first thing I do when I wake up, I actually, this is the corniest thing I'll say, I actually wake up a few minutes earlier so I can read through, and I have my notebook and I read your Rhetoric Warrior content, and it's you felt called to do this because, you know, I'll use my framing of it, but I think you felt like persuasion was being hijacked, and the stuff that you're doing, it's just gold. I mean, I only send you small pieces of what I'm getting out of it as feedback, just so you know how one man is interpreting some of this stuff. But it's a masterclass in how we did not become the most dominant species on the earth. We became the most dominant species because we could get along and do complicated stuff together. And we cannot risk screwing that up. And when you don't have persuasion, when you don't have conflict resolution skills, then you think you can drone strike stuff, right? We don't need more. I mean, not to get too far out afield with the metaphor, but the persuasion you need, we need that so that we can try to convince each other of stuff and not fight each other about stuff. That's, I know, grossly simplistic, but in that is a kernel of truth about we can't take our communication for granted,
right?
And how we talk. And just because I can send you a turd emoji or a thumbs up, and that's really easy and frictionless, that's not going to help me construct the kind of society I want to be able to live in. I can use all those things. I'm a big thumbs up guy, and I've been known to use a turd emoji on occasion. But dude, there's some stuff that, you know, a kitty cat with hearts in his eyeballs isn't, that's just not going to.
Not enough. Yeah. Yeah. Like I say, you know, especially now, and I think you pointed out very well with complicated times, you have to start raising your game. And
yeah,
I really appreciate when you give me feedback on those, because I don't get direct feedback from people that often outside of my small sphere. So it's always great when, you know, that floats in. And when I talk to people who have the course, they'll tell me that stuff. But you're, again, I think because you're a communicator, because that is your background, you assertively communicate, which is a great gift in the world. And I really appreciate it. So I like your emails.
Hey man, no problem. The Labrador keeps them coming. So
that's great. Well, this has been awesome, man. As I knew it would be, lots here. I think there's lots of people, if they watch the podcast, will be able to pull away from this. Anything you want to promote for yourself? Like if people want to go learn more about you, where do they go?
Sure. My last name is Tumlin, T-U-M-L-I-N. You can find me at tumlin.com. Also, love to give a plug to my wife. She's Cindy Baldy, all I's, C-I-N-D-I, B-A-L-D-I. She's a data scientist. Whatever intelligence you think I have, triple it, because that's her. And she has a company that uses, we do a lot of measurement in our work, because sometimes you have to try to figure out how you know what you know. That's really her wheelhouse, a lot more than mine. And her company is Culture, C-U-L-S-U-R-E, like culture, except sure, culture.com. And other than that, got to read those Rhetoric Warriors, man. Keep the Dr. Dan stuff coming, because it's amazingly focused and applied. And can't thank you enough for the privilege of talking to the people on your podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, super fun. And again, go check out Jeff. Hire him for your consulting gig. He will come in and sing Kumbaya in his own in his own way that won't sound like Kumbaya, but you'll get the same effects. Thanks for listening to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. And remember, get out there and learn something, because it turns out great persuasion changes everything. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Jeff.
Yep. Thank you, Dan.